Oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, due to a settlement, the court has only two causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are Esther Byrd and Kenneth Weckler, MDPA and Associates versus WCW from Harris County, and Christopher D. Rhodes versus Ione A. Batia from Harris County. In each of these arguments, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a recess in between the presentation of the two arguments. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience, and if you desire to hear a tape of the argument, you may make application with the clerk of this court. The court is now ready to hear from petitioner in Byrd versus WCW.
May it please the court, Ms. Cassidy and Byrd represent arguments for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm sorry, Mr. Houston. Dr. Wetcher and Ms. Byrd have elected, in the interest of time, a single presentation. Dr. Wetcher's deposition testimony reflects he has fully approved of both Ms. Byrd's opinions and her conduct in reaching her opinions. We invite questions from the court pertaining to Dr. Wetcher during this presentation. I would also remind the court that I am hearing impaired, and I appreciate the court's indulgence of that. Your Honors, we are here for three reasons. Principally, the Court of Appeals was mistaken in interpreting the nature of Ms. Byrd's communication. The Court of Appeals was mistaken in interpreting the judicial proceedings privilege, and the Court of Appeals was mistaken in interpreting the duty owed under the circumstances. First, the nature of the communication. Ms. Byrd and Dr. Wetcher are here first and foremost because Ms. Byrd came to a conclusion and reached an opinion and elected in reaching that conclusion and opinion to speak, to become the voice of a child. To become the voice of a child whom she perceived to be the victim of a crime, an assault, that depends on the victim not having a voice. We are here secondarily because of the nature of privilege. The Court of Appeals misunderstood this court's holding in James versus Brown and misunderstood the nature of the communication. We are here, thirdly, because the Court of Appeals erroneously recognized a new common law duty based solely on foreseeability, based on an incomplete balancing of the factors mandated by this court. This duty is premised and built on the presumption that a duty exists and that the presumed duty has been violated. The duty created by the Court of Appeals, in addition, violates common law, statutory, and rules that this court has adopted for judicial proceedings privileges. All of these errors are based on facts that simply have no support in the summary judgment record. Exhibit 13 to our application for writ of error contains the timeline. There has been some dispute about the standard of review, but regardless of which standard of review this court applies, it is critical to realize that there are two independent investigations that were ongoing. The investigation by CPS on the one hand and the investigation by the police on the other hand, before Ms. Byrd even became involved in this case. These proceedings proceeded separately and independently.
Can you elaborate on the nature of those investigations?
The nature of the investigation by Ms. Byrd, Your Honor?
No, by the two agencies that you say, the two independent investigations that were going on prior to Ms. Byrd getting involved in this case.
Initiated by the mother, not by Ms. Byrd. Wetchers, you might believe differently from the recital of the facts in the opinion of the Court of Appeals. The record does not support the Court of Appeals' suggestion that the mother went to Ms. Byrd independently seeking psychological counseling, reflected on page 51 of the Court of Appeals' opinion. The purpose was a referral first from United Way, who then referred the mother to the Wetcher Clinic in a crisis intervention situation. Why? Because the report could not be substantiated on the initial investigation of CPS. The investigation was ongoing and proceeded independently. The purpose of this referral also was not to discover, but to continue what was already ongoing, initiated at the instance of the mother. The record does not support the claim that the criminal charges were initiated also, right, based on conversations with Ms. Byrd. The criminal complaint was filed by the mother. Charges later were filed, but this proceeded independently. The record shows without input from Ms. Byrd. That is at page 100 of the transcript, page 301, page 396 to 97, and page 419 from three different witnesses. Finally,
what was the basis for the charges, if not the statement of Ms.
The
Byrd?
Basis of the...
Of the charges.
The criminal?
Of the criminal charges. What was the basis? Was it that one of the independent investigations, the PCS investigation or the police investigation?
Separate.
Or did Dr. Byrd's or Mrs. Byrd's...
No connection with Dr. Byrd, Your Honor.
Charges were filed apart from her statement?
Exactly.
What was the basis for the mother's reporting?
Outcry by the child.
Outcry to her or
to
Mrs.
Her.
Byrd?
To her. That's in the pleadings. Even if the pleadings are strictly construed and based only on the pleadings, that is in the pleadings, the criminal charges were filed and the CPS investigation started before she was involved.
Ms. Burns,
Justice Cornyn?
The trial court granted a summary judgment on two grounds. Even if the communication, the affidavit signed by Ms. Byrd, were privileged, does Dr. Wetcher's summary judgment depend on the absence of a doctor-patient relationship, or it cannot be sustained on the privilege, can it?
Dr. Wetcher's motion for summary judgment was based entirely on the prior motion for summary judgment, in addition to pointing out to the court that any liability that would be leveled against him would be based on respondeat principles. The last inference that is not supported by the record, that is claimed to be supported by the record, is the presumption of innocence. It is not undisputed that the father was innocent. The essence of this whole proceeding is that his innocence was disputed, and it was resolved in another proceeding, a collateral proceeding, in his favor. Why is guilt or innocence immaterial here? Because the harm perceived under the Court of Appeals opinion at the threshold is harm to any parent. It's a fair assumption from the opinion of the Court of Appeals that even a guilty parent would have this cause of action. Is that what the Court of Appeals meant to create? It is not so limited. It is also immaterial, it's not justified as an inference under the record, because Ms. Byrd never wavered in her opinion. She reached it over a progression of time, and she never wavered.
How much time did Mrs. Byrd actually spend with the child?
The record mentions a 10-minute interval, but in prior to that 10-minute interval with the child, in which he recounted. The recounting was extremely critical to her, the record shows. She spent a total of 90 minutes, again, in a crisis intervention mode. The record shows that it's unusual for her to spend that much time. She also, in the prior session, one with the mother and one with her common-law husband, she also listened to the tape. She had heard the tape recorded by the husband in which he recorded the child recounting the details of the assault. That was also prior to her meeting with the child.
Was there something, is there something in the record to the effect that instead of the plaintiff, it was the child's stepfather who was guilty of these assaults?
We take the position that that is not supported by the record logically, because the tape was of the child recounting to this person that the Court of Appeals makes a great deal of emphasis on suspicion of daddy. There is reference in the record to who daddy was, but it's not supported logically because the child is recounting to that same person.
What were the conditions under which that tape was made?
I beg your pardon?
What were the conditions under which that tape was made? It wasn't made in a...
That's not brought out in the record, Your Honor.
Ms. Byrne, in any person, it seems to me, could report suspected child abuse based on an outcry from the child and based on who the child identifies, point out a suspect. It doesn't seem to me that that requires any sort of specialized training. That doesn't require any sort of medical setting. Ms. Byrd was in a position as a professional to make the professional judgment as to whether or not abuse in fact occurred, but does she not step outside her medical expertise when she attempts to identify the perpetrator of the abuse as opposed to the medical abuse? Do we not have a problem in this case of her claiming that this Mr. White was not a patient of hers, she owed him no duty? That's what she's trying to claim, but in fact, did she not step outside of her professional role in attempting to identify the perpetrator of the abuse, as opposed to staying within her side of her role, which is to identify that abuse occurred?
The standard for people reporting by anyone under the statute is cause, that's all. Simple cause. I understand your question. The question then becomes, what is she supposed to do with this information? Once she becomes convinced, is she supposed to look at the statute and say, aha, non-accusatory, I'm going to withhold this information? She was convinced. The judicial proceedings privilege protects her right to convey that conviction. Irregardless of the correctness of it, that is in versus Brown, and that is what was misconstrued by the Court of Appeals. Now, we have handed out to the court a rather lengthy, privilege doesn't end, the inquiry does not end with privilege because the Court of Appeals went on to recognize a previously non-existent duty. Now, there are many factors. The court's most recent decision in Graff outlines those. It's a very serious responsibility. Nonetheless, it requires balancing of more than simple foreseeability. It requires balancing of all factors. The factors greatly predominate because of so much that is altered and destroyed and compromised by this ruling. We would like to present some challenges to the respondent in closing. We would ask the respondent to identify what would be required of Ms. Byrd. What is it that they want her to do? They have mentioned that they want her to report. Simply to report under the low standard of cause that abuse has occurred? Or do they really want her to investigate? There are very conflicting standards. A duty to investigate, which does not even apply because we have an ongoing investigation. Their reporting was already done. It's a useless act. And she says that right in her deposition testimony. I won't belabor the court, but it's on page 311. How does this newly recognized duty jive with the duty of disclosure that is present in the family code and the increasing enactments in the family code aimed at disclosure?
at
allowing the voice.
Excuse me, Ms. Byrne, you're not saying that Byrd complied with the reporting requirements in the family code?
No.
And what you're, you have two points. Either as a medical professional, she had no duty to a non-patient for proper diagnosis, or two, if she did have some sort of duty to Mr. White, she was privileged in her conduct because the affidavit she signed was a part of a judicial proceeding.
The judicial proceeding premise is not, it's not an if there's a duty. There is no duty because there is no connection with this person.
Okay, then I come back, I come back to my original question. If she was, as a part of a diagnosis of child abuse, it is not necessary to identify the perpetrator, correct?
For an ordinary person.
Well, in the medical context, the professional context, there's nothing inherent in the diagnosis that requires the practitioner to identify who perpetrated the abuse.
That's correct.
Is there something that, if I'm a medical practitioner and I've asked to assess the condition of this patient, is it within my medical, I don't know, purview to go beyond the diagnosis and actually say, I think father did this?
The answer is in this court's ruling in James versus Brown, free communication by witnesses serves the administration of justice undeterred by fear of defamation lawsuits.
And that brings us back to that this identification occurred in terms of an affidavit that was part of a judicial proceeding.
That's right. Part of an ongoing proceeding.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Joanne Story will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I'd like to take issue with some of the facts that Ms. Byrd has given to the court today. Since this was a summary judgment proceeding, and since the motions for summary judgment by the defendants in this case were directed solely to the pleadings without any supporting evidence, then the only standard of review that this court has recognized in determining what the facts are is to look solely to the plaintiff's pleadings and take all of the facts that are in those pleadings as true and to draw reasonable inferences from those pleadings in favor of the plaintiff.
Are you contending they should have filed exceptions before they moved for summary judgment?
Your Honor, I believe that if they had wanted to take issue with the duty question, for example, on whether or not in balancing the factors, foreseeability and social utility and so forth, were the factors to take into consideration, then they could have filed affidavits by medical professionals that the duty is dependent upon and the risk that the professional seeks to avoid is outweighed by the magnitude of imposing the duty on them is outweighed by their decision to treat the child and communicate their opinions and do what they feel is necessary. I think that in that regard, they could have filed an affidavit.
You're not contending this is a pleading problem, though.
I'm not saying that at all, but what I'm saying is that under the standard of review, the facts are taken in a light most favorable to the plaintiff, and there are no facts in this case that were brought forward by the defendants, entitling them to now claim that the facts are as they say.
What duty do you say Ms. Byrd breached that was owed to Mr. White?
The duty that she breached that was owed to Mr. White was the duty to conduct a reasonable investigation.
Now, why did she have a duty to conduct an investigation?
All professionals, healthcare professionals in particular, agree that they have a duty to conduct a reasonable investigation in this type of case to determine whether or not there is sexual abuse occurring and to later communicate that opinion, but the opinion must depend upon a reasonable investigation. In fact,
well, let's assume that as a medical practitioner, she is asked to determine whether or not abuse has occurred. And she says she is determined abuse has occurred, and let's just assume she was negligent as all get out in her conduct of her diagnoses and evaluation. And so Jared has been determined to have been an abused child, and Jared really wasn't. And so there's a cause of action. Now, who can bring that cause of action for that negligent diagnosis, treatment, evaluation, however you want to call it?
We're contending that, in our case, the father can bring the cause of action based upon the foreseeability of the risk and the other factors that this court traditionally looks to in determining whether to impose a duty.
Is the duty that she failed to conduct her evaluation properly, or is the duty that she disclosed her evaluation to others?
The duty is clearly to conduct a reasonable investigation, and her testimony by deposition was that following the 10-minute interview with the boy and following the 30 to 40 minute interview with the parents, that she could not conclude that sexual abuse had occurred. And in fact, she felt that further investigation was necessary. That is undisputed under the summary judgment evidence. She felt that further investigation was necessary. Because she couldn't, in addition to not being able to conclude whether sexual abuse occurred, she had no idea who Daddy was in light of the fact that she considered the people who brought the boy to her to be his parents, and in light of the fact that the boy's father had been in Florida for 6 months. So her deposition testimony establishes the duty to investigate. She recognized that she had that duty.
This duty would not be, is not necessarily limited to a medical professional. I take it you say all professionals have would have a duty. So an expert witness in a products liability case who files an affidavit opining that the let's say the plaintiff, that the defendant's product is defective, would there be a duty not to defame the product manufacturer, or how far does this duty extend?
In determining in that fact situation whether there would be a duty, the court would have to look at the traditional factors, the factors about
so it is but possibly, depending on how the factors are balanced, there could be a duty breached by an expert witness in a products liability case.
If I were to decide the question, applying the factors, I think I would have a serious question in that fact situation about whether the imposing the burden, the additional burden on that expert to do more than what he's hired to do, in other words, to look out for the other side, is much, much greater than the risk to that other person. Whereas in our case, the professional is already under a duty to exercise care. The professional acknowledges that she has a duty to exercise care in examining the child, examining the parents, and conducting a reasonable investigation, calling on colleagues to determine whether or not the child has in fact been abused. But where the testifying expert is potentially being sued, I personally would have a question about whether or not the consequences of placing an additional duty on the expert to look out for the third party. The risk involved is not as great as imposing that additional burden.
Excuse me, I want to be sure I understood you correctly a while ago. You left me at least with the impression that by your statement that Ms. Bird was under the impression when child was brought in that the mother and her husband were the child's natural parents, that these were the parents. She was not aware, apparently, of the plaintiff's existence.
I'm sorry if I left that impression. she characterized the mother and the common law husband as parents on some of the forms that she completed. I believe that she was well aware of the fact that the father had been in Florida for the last 6 months.
She was aware of the fact that he'd been in out of state for 6 months?
I believe so. And the question, therefore, in her mind was, not only had sexual abuse, she could not determine that sexual abuse had occurred, but who, in fact, daddy was. She could not make that determination.
Are you aware of the circumstances under which this tape recording was made? The one involving the stepfather and the child?
I'm not aware of the circumstances. I'm only aware that the common law husband recorded some comments that the child made.
No record of when, under what conditions, who was present,
no.
What other conversation might have taken place?
I'm not aware of what the circumstances are.
Ms. Stewart, you contend that the privilege or immunity that we recognize in James versus Brown pertaining to legal proceedings applies only to defamation cases, or would it extend to other causes of action that might be brought arising out of legal proceedings?
The privilege in James versus Brown applies only to libel and slander cases, according to that case. That case says that the witness immunity will not apply to preclude a suit for negligence.
Are you arguing that it's restricted, that it should be restricted only to defamation proceedings?
Yes, according to James versus Brown. And then the question is whether or not there's a duty. So while there may not be a privilege for a negligence case, for a negligence cause of action, for a communication made in the course of a judicial proceeding, we still would not impose liability unless we find that the defendant owed a duty to the person
so
claiming harm.
So the product liability expert witness could not rely on any privilege to bar suit brought against him or her in subsequent proceedings? It would totally turn on the question of duty.
If the holding in James versus Brown is still the law, and we believe that it is, yes. Yes.
According to opposing counsel, the charges, the report of abuse was made to authorities. Independent investigations were being conducted by Child Protective Services and the police, and charges were filed against the child's father, totally independent of Ms. Bird's diagnosis and statement. Is that correct?
I don't believe that the record supports that statement.
What does the record support?
I believe that the record shows that the mother took the boy to CPS, that the boy did not relate any story of sexual abuse to CPS, and CPS could not conclude in any way or fashion whether sexual abuse had occurred, and closed its file, and suggested to the mother that she go elsewhere. I'm not sure under the record whether they suggested that she go to United Way or whether they suggested that she go to Esther Bird. But I do believe that the record supports the fact that the mother then took it upon herself to take her son to Esther Bird in order to continue this claim of sexual abuse so that she could change custody. So there is no evidence under the record that CPS had conducted an investigation, that its file was open, and that it was ongoing on June 5th and on June 6th when the mother took the boy to Esther Bird.
And Ms. Bird's conclusion at that time was that she could not determine whether sexual abuse had occurred, much less if there was a perpetrator or who the identity of the perpetrator might be. Is that correct?
Correct.
But then she felt sure enough in her diagnosis later on to give a statement that there had been sexual abuse and that the child's father was a perpetrator. Is that correct?
That's what she did. There's no evidence in the record that with any further investigation, nothing further was done by Esther Bird in the interim. 1 week, she concluded that she didn't know whether sexual abuse had occurred. didn't know who Daddy was, and a week later she made unequivocal statements of fact in her affidavit.
Wasn't the child also interviewed by a police investigator?
I don't believe that the child was interviewed. I believe that the police investigator may have listened to the tape, but it's certainly clear under the record that the police investigator called Esther Byrd, and according to the summary judgment evidence, the criminal charges, the actual criminal charges that were brought against Mr. White were brought based upon the comments that Esther Byrd made to the police investigator, including a letter to the police investigator saying, if there's anything further that I can do to help, please let me know. Justice Cornyn, I think I have an example of how James versus Brown applies in a situation a little different than ours. I think we would have to agree that if I hire an expert in contemplation of litigation, and my expert were to conduct an irresponsible investigation, not conduct an investigation of the facts as he is required to do under the standards of conduct governing his profession, and if he were to then communicate that his opinion, contrary to what I would hoped it would be in support of my case, and later communicate that opinion in the course of a judicial proceeding, under the holding of James versus Brown, he would not have a privilege. In other words, I would not be barred from suing him merely based upon the fact that he had simply communicated that opinion in the course of a judicial proceeding. And we would certainly agree that he owes me a duty in that case. Let's take a situation where a mother takes a child to a psychologist and the boy is being abused terribly, and the psychologist conducts an irresponsible investigation but concludes that the boy is not being abused and writes an affidavit saying, it's my professional opinion that this boy has not been abused. Are we going to protect her actions and her conduct merely because she made that communication in the course of a judicial proceeding? So while I understand the court's concerns about how far this goes, I think that the court has...
Isn't that a different scenario, counsel? Because you're talking about diagnosis of whether abuse occurred, and presumably within the purview of an expert, but same experts may have opinions regarding who a perpetrator is after thorough examination, investigation. But that's not the same as determining whether abuse has occurred. It seems to me that the simpler question, the easier question, though very difficult to under by any measure, is whether abuse occurred, period, not who committed the abuse.
I think that
one relates to the guilt of a particular party. The other relates to whether the incident occurred at all, or the incidents.
I think it's offensive that this affidavit made unequivocal assertions of fact based upon an irresponsible investigation. But the crux of our cause of action against the professional is to impose a duty upon her to act like a professional and to observe standards of conduct applicable to her profession in investigating the allegations before she communicates the opinion.
How is this duty anything other than defamation by another man? I'm trying to think of the instances where medical professionals can be sued, can be liable in damages to someone other than the person they had direct contact with in a patient or quasi-patient physician relationship, or patient-counselor relationship, and that is loss of consortium, wrongful death. There may be others, but this seems to me that these damages are identical with what the damages that your client suffered are: injury to reputation, the losses that came about due to these statements, and that's identical to defamation. And under your theory, any defamation case could also be a negligence case with a 2-year statute of limitations, for instance. and without the constitutional protection that the United States Supreme Court has imposed in defamation matters.
I think the damages under a negligence cause of action are very similar to a defamation case. Certainly we'll agree that under a negligence case, a plaintiff is entitled to recover whatever damages approximately result from the negligence, from the breach of the duty. And so to that extent, yes, the damages are the same. But I don't believe that it has ever been held that merely because an alternative cause of action may exist, that a plaintiff is limited to that particular cause of action to the exclusion of all others.
So if you plead for negligence as opposed to defamation, then you can plead around the privilege?
Well, it's our position that there is no privilege in this case because of the holding in James versus Brown, which simply says that there's no privilege merely where the communication is merely, the opinion is merely communicated later in a judicial proceeding. The pivotal inquiry is going to be whether we're going to impose a duty.
Is the reason for the privilege the same or different? I understand that, and I agree with you, that James v. Brown was limited to defamation proceedings. But if there's a privilege against defamation, why isn't there a privilege under these facts?
A privilege to act in an unreasonable manner in investigating an allegation of sexual abuse of a child is really
a privilege for a person participating in judicial proceedings to give evidence, even if it's wrong.
Well, we all know that the courts have gone a long way to protecting communications made in a judicial proceeding. But if you look at the cases that predate James versus Brown, they every one of them talks simply about causes of action for defamation. That privilege applies only to libel and slander cases, not the negligence cases, and then the next inquiry that has to be made in order to determine whether liability will ever be imposed is whether there's a duty.
Mr. Story, how do you respond to the argument that the duty created by the Court of Appeals in this case is contrary to the immunity given by the legislature to people assisting and reporting of child abuse under 3403?
I have two answers to that, Your Honor. Number one, the immunity that is afforded by the Family Code is afforded only when the professional falls within the Family Code and meets the Family Code's requirements that they make an immediate report, an immediate non-accusatory report, and then in that instance they would be entitled to immunity from civil suit if the non-accusatory report is not made in bad faith. More importantly, the defendants in this case never pleaded statutory immunity, as a ground for excusing their conduct in this case. The only immunity that they ever pleaded was the witness immunity for defamation.
Counsel, is there any way that Dr. Wexler could be held responsible if Dr. Bird was not, or is his liability totally one of respondeat?
The pleadings are not just for respondeat superior. The pleadings allege an independent cause of action against Dr. Wetcher for failing to supervise her properly and in hiring somebody without the proper qualifications. In other words,
there wasn't much pleading on that, but is there any analogous case authority of a... I guess we can look at the other cases against hospitals for negligent doctors and such, and that's the type of...
That's
the type of authority you look at.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you distinguish this case from Vineyard versus Kraft and Dominguez versus Kelly and the Wyoming Supreme Court case and Elmer versus Van Horn?
In all three of those cases, it was undisputed that the professional had complied with the statutory provisions requiring that a report be made in all three of those cases. In the Vineyard case, the professional never made unequivocal statements accusing, never made an unequivocal statement accusing a particular person of having done the abuse. In Vineyard, the crux of the cause of action in Vineyard by the father was not the reasonableness of the care, treatment, or investigation, because if you look at Vineyard, that professional had quite a relationship with the child, had been treating the child, had seen the child over several occasions, and had been communicating all of his opinions later in a judicial setting. Every one of the opinions in that case were in the course of a judicial proceeding. What the father in Vineyard was really complaining about was not what the professional had done leading up to the communication of the opinion, because he really couldn't. What he was complaining about was the professional's communication to the mother, which caused her to take the child out of the state, and the subsequent communication in the course of the judicial proceeding. And in Vineyard, the father never asked the court to look at James versus Brown and impose liability for negligence, recognizing that the privilege only applies to defamation cases. In Dominguez, the court clearly held that there was immunity because of the reporting that was done by the professional in accordance with the family code. More importantly, in Dominguez, the court never looked at the traditional factors in determining whether there was duty. The court simply went on the proposition, which has been rejected in Texas, that in the absence of a physician-patient relationship, there's no duty, period. So the Court of Appeals held, and we agree, that since the case in Dominguez was decided on immunity, the court's discussion of duty was dicta.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Could you explain to me why Dr. Wechter does not have exposure, even if Dr. Bird does not? The different considerations between Dr. Wechter and Dr. Bird's liability.
The essence really is respondeat superior because of the evidence that's in the record, because Dr. Wechter fully approved of all of Ms. Bird's actions and fully approved of the opinion that she reached. And it implies that he would have reached the same conclusion. He reinforces the priceless intervention nature of the proceeding. This is necessarily relevant to the standard of care.
Excuse me.
Justice,
we have a crisis intervention, and I'm concerned. I realize we're dealing with a child here. Timetables are not as critical on an evidentiary basis when you're dealing with children as they are with adults. But the father had been out of state for 6 months and had no physical contact apparently with the child for more than 6 months. And the mother had taken the child to a child protective services. They could reach no conclusions. They couldn't determine abuse had occurred. She took the child in for counseling with Ms. Bird. Is it true that Ms. Bird's conclusions, diagnosis at the time of the interview, with the interviews with the mother, the common law husband, and the child were inconclusive, that she could not determine whether abuse had occurred at that time, much less who the perpetrator might be? Is that true?
This addresses the focus on suspected
How do you get crisis intervention out of it?
First of all, the crisis intervention became because despite the father's departure by his own pleadings from the state for a period of 6 months, the outcry came because the child was to be returned to the custody of the father. Those are the circumstances set out by the respondent's own pleading. In addition, equally responsive to the allegation about the pleadings not supporting the inferences, the issue of the further investigation is right at the TR 47 and 48. The CPS investigation began. She was referred to Ms. Bird by CPS and United Way, and she referred them back She referred them back. She was a cog in the wheel.
What were her conclusions at the time of the interview?
At the time, she concluded, her deposition testimony says that she reached her conclusion based on four factors, the tape that she listened to.
Now, what were her conclusions at the time?
Conclusion at the time was the opinion that abuse had occurred.
This conflicts directly with what your opposing counsel has said her conclusions were.
In what respect, Your Honor?
Your opposing counsel says that at the time of these interviews, at the time she examined the child, she could not determine whether sexual abuse had occurred.
That's why she referred them back for the continuing investigation. It's twisting the words.
Is that true? She could not conclude?
No, Your Honor, because the focus is on the allegation of suspected abuse. That is on the intake form. What was the diagnosis at the time? Suspected abuse. That is on the intake form. Referring back to CPS to continue the investigation. The investigation was ongoing. Pursuant to the investigation, the volunteer lawyer contacted her. It was obvious that the investigation...
I'm still not sure you have answered my question as to what her conclusions were. The intake form, this is why the child was brought in, suspected abuse. What were Ms. Bird's conclusions at the time?
That abuse had occurred at the hands of the father.
At that time.
Based on in that interval. Then she referred them back, and within a week's time, she swore out the affidavit reflecting that opinion. She based this on the tape, the narration, and the request to stop. It's very critical for Ms. Bird. The request conveyed by the child that the father stop.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.